From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America presents Issues in the News. The nation's top Washington correspondents offer their perspectives on the week's major stories. Your moderator is Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Issues in the News begins now.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Joining me on the show this week are Abdirahim Fukara, Washington Bureau Chief of Al Jazeera Satellite TV, and Stephen Collinson, White House correspondent of Agence France-Presse. And here are the issues. A Malaysian airliner was shot down over eastern Ukraine, the region where Russia-backed rebels are active, and earlier claimed to have downed two military planes of the Ukrainian government. Russia denied any involvement in the rocket attack on the airliner, which had 298 people aboard. Israeli ground troops launched a ground attack into Gaza, and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said the invasion would be broadened. And in Washington, President Obama suggested he will seek to extend nuclear talks with Iran beyond the July 20 deadline. Well, a lot to talk about. Stephen, let me talk with you. We don't know for sure who brought this Malaysian airliner down, but all signs point to the Russia-backed rebels. And the repercussions from this are, what are the repercussions?
Right. There are multiple repercussions that are going to follow on from this. There's, I guess, two strands of this. The first part is finding out who's to blame, conducting an investigation into this disaster. And then secondly, the sort of geopolitical ramifications that will take place, you know, relative to the war in Ukraine, a civil war in Ukraine. The first thing is, you know, these air accident investigations are tough enough at the best of times, trying to find out what happened to a plane. This is going to take place on a civil war battleground. So you have immediate issues of securing the evidence. The White House, in the hours after the disaster, quickly came out and said that no evidence must be moved from the debris field there in eastern Ukraine. It seems to me that they're already very worried that either separatists or the Russians will try and cover up exactly what took place. You've got air accident investigators. How do they get to this site? Are they going to be secure? You have those kind of issues. How do they, you know, next of kin, how do they, the terrible business of even recovering bodies? I mean, in the middle of this hot civil war that's going on. And then sort of going forward, how does this impact the showdown between the West and Russia over Ukraine? I think one immediate consequence of this is that the Europeans are going to be under a great deal of pressure from their public to toughen their stance against the Russians. This week, we saw the United States impose toughened sanctions on the finance, energy, and military sectors of the Russian economy. Some big firms were targeted. The Europeans kind of went along with that, but their sanctions were much less stringent. They sort of introduced some bans on investment from the, you know, European investment banks in Russia. So the immediate impact, I think, is the Europeans are going to have to toughen their stance. And where does this leave President Putin? Is he going to be under pressure to cut his losses? Will he face some political pressure inside Russia to sort of tone down his approach on Ukraine? So it kind of scrambles the whole crisis. Mm-hmm. It seems kind of ghoulish to talk about the implications when, you know, 300 people have died in an air crash, but that's kind of where we are.
Abdi, what's your take?
Well, my take is that President Putin has no good place in all of this. With regard to the plane, if it does turn out, and all the signs are there, that it was hit by a missile, where did the missile come from? Whether it had come from the rebels, whether it had been smuggled from Russia, the rebels do not have that kind of technology. So regardless of the source of the missile, Putin obviously finds himself in a difficult position with regard to what happened. And as Steve said, this comes against the background of relations already strained between Russia and the West. Despite all the sanctions and what happened with this plane in Ukraine and all that, I do not see how President Putin could backpedal on his position on Ukraine and what he's done there over the last few months. But clearly, he's in a very bad pickle economically, geostrategically, particularly in terms of relations with the United States. The United States still needs Vladimir Putin on a wide range of issues, particularly the Iranian nuclear talks, he remains pivotal. And the United States, as we've heard from President Obama, is very reluctant to rock the boat with the Russians on that particular one. But nonetheless, Putin finds himself increasingly cornered after the crash.
Stephen, here I want to read you a couple sentences from a Wall Street Journal editorial involving the subject of Putin. And it says, if not for President Putin, none of this would be happening. The conflict was conceived, funded, and armed by Russia. This is the conflict between the Ukrainian government and the rebels in eastern Ukraine. The commander of the separatist forces is a Russian military intelligence officer. The leader of the separatist government in Donetsk is a resident of Moscow. Russia denied that they had played any role in this and suggested the Ukrainian government shot down the Malaysian airliner. I can't think of what the motive would have been for the Ukrainian government. But in any case, the ultimate blame, as I think Abdi was suggesting, goes to President Putin.
Right.
One way or another.
Right. And President Putin has used this crisis to sort of bolster his own political position in Russia. He's, you know, fanned the flames of nationalism. I mean, you can make the argument that this Ukrainian civil war, the roots of it are not down to Vladimir Putin. It's an ancient historical dispute, but he has clearly sort of exacerbated the tensions, used the tensions politically. He came into office a couple of years ago for his second term as president, and he took a distinctly anti-Western position. He was under significant political pressure in Russia. You know, there's he's cracked down on human rights, on media freedom. So we often talk about him as a strongman, but his position isn't completely unassailable. And he's used the idea of sort of recreating this Russian sphere of influence to sort of bolster his own political position and the political position of Russia, which he thinks, you know, in the last 20 years, Russia's been insulted. It's not been treated like a great power that it should be for the Soviet Union. So I think the editorial is correct that, you know, Vladimir Putin didn't sit there a year ago and think, well, this is what I'm going to do, and the risk is that a civilian airliner could get shot down. But, you know, these things have cascading consequences. The one thing that sort of occurs to me is that, you know, people, families got on a plane in the Netherlands on Thursday morning, and suddenly they became casualties of a civil war raging on the outskirts of Europe. I mean, it has almost this tragic randomness, you know, that Europe's often seen. Civilians throughout the last 100, 150 years have been pulled into deadly circumstances, tragedies, by the geopolitical tensions and the nationalism that still kind of rages in Europe and on the fringes of Europe. So it's kind of a reminder that, you know, we think our times are more peaceful and more tranquil than perhaps the last century, but the consequences of these nationalistic and, you know, sectarian and territorial conflicts can still be very grave.
Omni, you've said, suggested that Putin cannot back down, and I think you're right, and he won't, but much stronger sanctions are a possibility. It's easier for the United States and President Obama to put in place stronger sanctions. The U.S. does not have all the economic ties with Russia that Germany and other European countries do. I think it puts pressure particularly on the European countries in this regard.
It certainly does. I mean, the country that has been most reluctant to go along with the sanctions is, ironically, in Europe, that is the country that has the most economic clout in Europe, and that is Germany. The Germans obviously have a lot of stake in Russia and in maintaining good economic relations with Russia. There has been obviously some disagreement within the European Union how to deal with the issue of sanctions. But like Steve said, now even Germany, after the downing, if it is downing indeed, of the aircraft in Ukraine, it's going to be increasingly tough for the Europeans not to come closer to the US position. And what's going to make it even more difficult for them to keep some sort of daylight between their positions and the US position on the sanctions on Russia is precisely the latest round of sanctions imposed by the US Treasury on the Russians. Inevitably, they will affect Russia, and they will affect their dealings, the European dealings, economic dealings, financial dealings with that country. But you also have to bring to mind what Putin said in Brazil with regard to the sanctions. He said the sanctions usually have a boomerang effect. Yes, he conceded they will hurt Russia, and they have already hurt Russia, but he is counting on the eventuality that long-term they will boomerang against U.S. companies working in Russia, although the stakes for, as you said, for President Obama, because of the level of financial and economic involvement, the stakes are not as high for the U.S. as they are high for Russia. Let me just add this. Mm-hmm. When there is a crisis, as Steve said, you can go back in search of its source. You can go back decades, you can go back centuries. But you can also go back just a few years. I think that there's a very strong temptation in various parts of the world to say, if President Obama had confronted much more stringently Vladimir Putin in Syria, Putin would not have been so emboldened as to do what he's done in Ukraine. I'm not saying this is a scientific statement. Mm-hmm. It's one interpretation of the situation. Both countries had obviously a common interest in Syria, and that is radical jihadi groups. The Russians were extremely worried about them. They have their own in Chechnya and surrounding republics. But if you look back on how these groups have exponentially grown since then, perhaps there is some allowance to be made for the argument that if President Obama had confronted Putin much more stringently in Syria, the situation over Ukraine would have been somewhat different today.
Well, that's an interesting argument. Stephen, what do you make of that argument that President Obama should have been tougher in perhaps bombing Syria after the Syrian government had crossed the red line that Obama had mentioned and used chemical gas against his own people?
Yeah, I think that in some senses, the sort of narrative that Obama was weak in Ukraine and therefore U.S. alliances and security guarantees to countries in the Eastern Europe, for example, or over in Asia, are seen as less strong, is sometimes taken a bit too far. But in a sense, it doesn't really matter, because whatever the president's intentions and decisions, it's clear that Vladimir Putin thinks that he's weak. And that's really the question that matters. It's almost, you know, the president will take decisions based on what he sees as U.S. national security interests. But it's clear that Vladimir Putin, who's a sort of, you know, a very shrewd, scheming politician who sort of weighs up the strengths and weaknesses of various world leaders, he believes that the president is weak and there's an opportunity for him to spread, you know, his own and Russian influence throughout the Middle East. So that's the real question. The interesting thing is that throughout all this, the White House has kept lines of communication to Vladimir Putin open. I mean, it's tried to isolate him on the international stage, but there, you know, there have been probably 10 calls since the beginning of the Ukraine crisis between the president and Vladimir Putin. Mm-hmm. Putin talks more regularly to European leaders like Angela Merkel. So it's the White House is trying to play a kind of difficult game here. The question is, where does it go from here with President Putin? The interesting thing is that President Putin is probably going to be there for another 5, 6, 7, 8 years. Who knows how long, you know, he's going to be there. This president is leaving in 2 years. I think the most interesting question is how the next president comes to power and deals with Vladimir Putin. I know for a fact that out in Asia, in China, President Xi Jinping is already talking to U.S. analysts that go out there about the next president. He's already sees the president as a lame duck, so President Obama as a lame duck. So I think we're going to see this reflected in the campaign for the White House in the next couple of years. I don't think there's a U.S. foreign policy consensus in Washington about how to deal with Russia right now. I mean, you don't really want to, you know, wage a kind of Cold War-style conflict, but at the same time, how do you deal with it? It's a real difficult problem.
I think Stephen's right about that. There is no consensus in the U.S. about how to deal with Putin. Republicans and some Democrats ask for tougher sanctions. They often aren't very specific about that. But beyond that, nobody seems to want to resume the Cold War as an international phenomenon that it was for so many decades. But let me, Abdi, I want to ask another question that's been raised, and that is, why was the Malaysian plane flying over this area where there's a civil war and two military planes of the Ukrainian government had been shot down by rockets earlier in the week? It would seem to me, I'm not trying to blame the Malaysians for what happened, but it would seem to me they might want to have taken a slightly different route.
I mean, there are other questions that you could raise about the responsibility of the Malaysians. Remember, the world is still lost as to exactly what happened to the Malaysian plane that disappeared just a few months ago. So there's obviously something going on there. But the other question, not about the Malaysians, about the Russians and the Ukrainians. Mm-hmm. If you know that you've had this conflict raging on in that part of the world for several months now, why was airspace, that particular corridor, why was it still open the way it seems to have remained open, mm-hmm, to international navigation? And what will the consequences of that particular Malaysian plane, what happened to it there, what are the consequences going to be now for the military conflict on the ground? Steve mentioned to one rub in this whole Malaysian plane situation is that obviously you need to investigate what happened, but you're going to have to conduct this investigation in a part of territory which is aflame, where it's going to be logistically and in terms of security extremely difficult to investigate and follow all the leads that you need to follow to establish exactly what happened and who bears what responsibility.
We're going to have to take a break in just a moment, but first, yeah, just to finish off this, what is likely to happen? I suspect there'll be some finding, whether it's from an independent group or not, and the finding may be disputed, and I can't see much more happening than toughened sanctions.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it kind of raises the question what exactly the West can do to influence the behavior of Russia, and
that was
really
a question I was
not
trying
very much.
To...
I mean, if you don't impose sanctions, what are your options? There's no question of military action. I mean, in these situations, you often have sanctions or you have some kind of military action. Mm-hmm. They've already kicked Russia out of the G7. I think you might see some more overt U.S. support for the Ukrainian government, whether it's, you know, training for the military, etc., etc. One kind of wrinkle of this is that, you know, for a long time, the U.S. has resisted sending surface-to-air missiles to rebels in Syria, precisely because they're frightened of what might happen to the threat, mm-hmm, of commercial aviation. A lot of those CIA officers that were in Benghazi when the consulate was attacked were there because they were trying to track down surface-to-air missiles which were used in the which were in the Libyan inventory. And when, you know, the country basically fell apart, they don't know where these missiles are. So I think one aspect of this is it makes it almost inconceivable that the U.S. is going to send, you know, anti-aircraft missiles into the Syrian conflict and is going to do what it can to prevail on its allies not to do so either.
Well, we're going to have to take a break. I'll come to you, Abdi, when we get back, and we need to talk about the Israeli invasion of Gaza. But we will have more in just a minute. First reminder, you're listening to Issues in the News, coming to you on The Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Joining me on the show today are Steve Collinson of AFP and Abdirahim Fukara of Al Jazeera. And this is a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com. Abdi, you don't need to say anything more about this shooting down of the Malaysian plane unless you want to, but we need to move on to the Israeli invasion, which the Prime Minister Netanyahu says will be broadened. It seems to me that the Israelis are going to probably be in Gaza for a relatively long time. In other words, they don't look like they're going in and we'll take out a few, they'll find some rocket sites and then move out.
I mean, I have a sense that the Israelis do not really know where this is going to take them. And I have a sense that Hamas, at this particular point, called to the ceasefire as arranged by the Egyptians, having been refused by Hamas for their own reasons. It seems to me that Hamas doesn't know either where this whole situation is leading. But one thing we know for sure, two things, in fact. One is that ultimately, as in every conflict in Ukraine, as we talked about conflicts everywhere, civilians always bear the brunt of these conflicts. Civilians are paying the price for what's going on in Gaza. And the other thing which President Obama has reiterated several times over the last few days is that at the end of the day, you could have this conflict, you could pay the price politically if you scale back, if you're Benjamin Netanyahu, pay the price politically at home and abroad, and you could pay the price if you are Hamas in Gaza and regionally getting much more isolated. At the end of the day, there is the fundamental issue here which will have to be resolved and for which there is no prospect of a solution at the present time, and that's the issue of occupation. What are the Israelis and the Palestinians going to do about this issue? As we know, John Kerry has tried for several months intensively. That didn't lead to anything. It was almost doomed. His effort was almost doomed. But at least he tried, and he tried consummately. That didn't go anywhere. So this particular crisis now in Gaza, Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, has committed himself to do what he needs to do, as he promised public opinion in Israel. We don't know what that is. Is his ultimate goal to destroy the tunnels, to destroy the hardware that Hamas has, or is his ultimate goal to actually destroy Hamas itself as an organization? If that's what he's trying to do, he faces several challenges. One of them is that, as hateful as he feels at the prospect of keeping Hamas in Gaza, Hamas, for all the wrong things that he thinks Hamas is doing, and a lot of people in the region agree with him, not least the Egyptians, Hamas at the end of the day does serve to control the other factions. We keep talking about how this is not just about Hamas firing rockets into Israel. There are other more radical factions in Gaza. And just one last thought.
Sure.
The Americans, the Egyptians, the Israelis, there's been a lot of criticism, for example, in Egypt of the Muslim Brotherhood as a radical organization, as Sisi called it. He, Sisi, the president of Egypt, sees Hamas as an extension of the Muslim Brotherhood.
Mm-hmm.
When you hear and see what other groups in the region are doing, Daesh, the ISIS in Iraq, then you see the next wave coming, which makes Hamas and the Muslim Brotherhood look extremely moderate. And I think that is the danger that the Palestinians, the Israelis, and the people in the neighborhood now face.
Stephen, I want your take on this, but a few days ago, maybe it was a couple of weeks ago, the UN General Secretary said, well, the first thing that has to happen, if we're going to arrange anything, this is before the invasion, is Hamas needs to stop rocketing Israel. What if that happened? Would that really change things or not?
Well, we had a conflict like this in 2012. It was ended by a ceasefire brokered by the US and Egypt, the former Muslim Brotherhood government of Egypt, and it stopped it temporarily, but it didn't really change the equation in the long term. It's interesting that the White House, given Israel a lot of latitude, you know, the president has had a fairly testy relationship with Benjamin Netanyahu. I think the administration feels that Netanyahu in some ways didn't have much choice politically to do what he did. He had to stop these rockets raining down. It was interesting. I was at an iftar dinner on Monday night in the White House, which was a gathering of diplomats from Muslim countries, which is hosted every year by this president and President Bush before him to mark the holy month of Ramadan. And while talking about the need for both sides to protect civilians, the president was quite vehement in saying that these rocket attacks are inexcusable and that they should be stopped. So one of the things that's kind of, I think, helping the administration is we don't see the kind of pressure from its Arab allies and its European allies, notwithstanding the terrible sort of civilian tragedies we've seen in Gaza, for the White House to weigh in. What the reasons for that, I don't know. I think Hamas is increasingly isolated in the Middle East. Obviously, it doesn't have its relationship with Egypt anymore. Two people said to me sort of privately this week that it's almost like there's so much tragedy and turmoil and bloodletting in Syria and Iraq. This confrontation is almost not getting the kind of headlines that it would, you know, that it has in the past. So it sounds terrible to say it, but it's almost like the bar on atrocity has been risen, and as a result, the kind of normal political pressure you might see in the White House to step in and mount some kind of mediation effort, we're not really seeing that.
Abdi, you know, one of the things that I suspect is going to happen is that the Israelis will win the war, but they'll lose politically, and diplomatically, and in public opinion, and we'll be back where we started.
Indeed, we have seen this before. Mm-hmm. It's not what you do with the hardware; it's what you do with the politics. That's where the real achievement is. And with regard to the position that Barack Obama has taken, remember that in 2008, when he was just being elected president, he kept a very low profile and he let the Israelis do what they felt that they had to do with regard to Hamas. This time around, he is saying the Israelis have the right to protect themselves, but he is also repeatedly calling on them to do everything they can to limit the damage to civilians. It's quite a nuance in his position. But remember, this conflict comes now not when Barack Obama is being elected. It comes when the United States Congress is getting ready for its elections. Mm-hmm. Anything that he says, although he's not running for a third term, but there are Democrats who will be running for Congress. Anything he says has to be carefully calibrated because he wants to give the impression that he cares about civilians. And that would help somewhat, I think that's the calculation, isolate Hamas and any political achievements that it may be able to claim. But at the same time, he doesn't want to give ammunition to his critics now that the country is on the verge of an election campaign for Congress to use against Democrats. If he sounds any less nuanced, he becomes even more toxic to Democrats, other Democrats running for Congress.
That's a good point. Now, we did not get to the question of the extension of the Iranian-U.S. Nuclear talks. Unless somebody screams no, I think we all agree that they will continue. They will be extended past July 20th, and we'll be discussing them again sometime in the future. But that's all the time we have today. Joining us were Abdirahim Fukara, Washington Bureau Chief of Al Jazeera Satellite TV, and Stephen Collinson, White House Correspondent for Asia France Press. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Thanks for listening.
From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Issues in the News. You can email your questions or comments to our panelists. Send them to voanews@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune in the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us next week at this time for Issues in the News.